There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. We've got a fabulous guest for you this week, the author and presenter, Emma Jabiri. Firstly, here's some official podcast business. It's a week to go until the Margate Bookie, Kent's fun, friendly literary festival. We have an all-star lineup, including Deborah Levy, Tessa Hadley, Lou Sanders, Andy Osho, Lucy Vine, Yomi Adegoke, Laura Kay, Adam Kay, no relation, I don't think, Grace Dent, Andy Miller, and producer Dale, and your good friend me. MargateBookie.com for tickets. There are still places available for my creative fiction course, Write Like a Reader, starting on Sunday the 29th of October. It's going to be so much fun. I'll be sharing absolutely everything I know about novel writing, and most importantly, boosting your confidence, being your emotional cheerleader, and showing you how to keep going when you feel frustrated and stuck. If you listen to this podcast, I promise that you're capable of writing a great novel. It's all within you, and I want to help you bring it out. The course is designed to be suitable for writers of all levels, whether you're starting your first book or your 100th. Email me at creativeconfidenceclinic@gmail.com for information. You can also join me at the Creative Confidence Clinic on Substack. There's plenty of book chat there too. Now, on to today's guest. Emma Jabiri is an Irish author, academic and broadcaster, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. We're here to celebrate her latest book, Disobedient Bodies, published to coincide with the Cult of Beauty exhibition at the Wellcome Collection. We talked about E. Nesbitt, Political Books for Beginners, and how we make time to read. So I'd love to start by asking you about your relationship with reading, if you've always been a big reader, and what were the first books that really sparked that for you, and if you had moments of falling out of love and coming back to reading again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I've read for, I would say I've been like deeply committed to books like since I was seven. I think I like always had books around, but I remember like a real turning point of being seven, maybe eight, I think seven though, and going to Nigeria where my dad is from on holiday, and we were there for a month, and for some reason, like I have a really big family out there, but like nobody was around. Like none of my cousins were around. There was just no one around. I was staying with my grandparents and there was no one around for me to play with. And I was really, really bored. And there was no TV. There was nothing to do. And then I found a copy. I think it had been my dad's when he was a child, of like The Five Children and It, like Victorian, like children's book. And I read that and I was like just like super, super engrossed in it. And I ended up like having such a good holiday because I was just like so into that book. And I feel like that was like, yeah, that was like the beginning of an ongoing lifelong love of books.
I love that book so much. And my memory of it is that the world that E. Nesbitt paints, to me, and I've not read it for so long, so I might have got this wrong.
Yeah, I haven't read it for years.
It felt quite knowing. I thought, and the best children's authors do this, but she was so great at not making you feel like a child. It was very much a sort of a universe where children were respected. And I think she's really good at... because they did a really beautiful TV adaptation as well. And I'm not sure if I'm remembering the book or the telly, but I think the children all wish to be as beautiful as the day, which brings us back very nicely to your new book. But they sort of think, oh, you know, people are mean to us and don't treat us well because they don't like the way we look. And if we're all gorgeous, then, you know, the world will be so much easier. And actually what happens is people don't recognise them and they sort of get shooed away from places, and it's the beauty they wish for really doesn't open the doors they expect that it will.
Oh my god, this is crazy, because I do not remember that from the book, but that's such a theme of disobedient bodies. Wow. Like, because that book was so influential on me, but I haven't read it like since I was a child. I read it again as a child, but I've not actually read it as an adult. And I don't remember that wish. I don't remember that part of it, but it's so interesting that it's like a theme that's very present in the book I just wrote.
I was just thinking, as I was saying it, that it does seem very, very linked. Are there any books, either novels or memoirs or nonfiction books, with themes that you do feel were sort of, you know, gathering when you were thinking about disobedient bodies?
So I feel like another book that's been like really influential on me is a book called Woman on the Edge of Time, written in the 1970s, and it's, the author is a Marxist and a feminist. It's like, it's slightly sci-fi and like fantastical, and this very put upon Latinx woman is locked up, is, you know, has a life of like quite a lot of like abuse and poverty and stuff, and she ends up being institutionalized and put in this put in an asylum. Like, it's a really awful place. And then she's having these visions. And so you're never quite sure if she's having these, if she is actually time traveling, or if she is like hallucinating, but I think she's time traveling. She goes to this future that's like very, very like technically advanced, but very rooted in like indigenous knowledge. So it's this kind of idea of like ancient futures. And I feel like a lot of the like themes, a theme that is consistent across the three books I've written now, is me like looking at the kind of like ancestral practices of both sides of my heritage to see what can be kind of gleaned from pre-colonial or pre-Christian in Ireland, pre-Christian or pre-colonial in Nigeria, kind of knowledge systems, kind of like suppressed and oppressed knowledge systems that could kind of help us think through creatively or differently the problems that we're currently experiencing. And when I reread Woman on the Edge of Time, again, I felt like I'd forgotten it, but when I reread it a few years ago, I was just like, oh my gosh, there are so many like similarities with her, with this kind of idea of like of ancient futures that is like really present in that book. So I think that like was influential. A nonfiction book that has been like very influential on me, I think I probably quote from it in every book I've written, is called The Undercommons, Fugitive Planning and Black Study. Yeah. And it's about this concept of fugitivity. And the authors take the idea, the concept of fugitivity, from the very real concrete historical practice of enslaved people escaping their plantations, becoming fugitives, and trying to get to or to create these free, like maroon communities. And so they kind of take the metaphor of fugitivity and talk about kind of like escaping from late stage capitalist kind of neoliberal hellscape that we currently inhabit. And I feel like that book is extremely radical and complex and kind of mind blowing in its proposals. And I feel that's been very influential on me, and also given me the freedom I feel like to be kind of a little bit out there with my ideas.
In a way, and you know, please like disagree, because I do not want to tell you what your books are about, but in your books and in these books you've mentioned, there's this theme of hope underpinning everything. And I think sometimes I forget when people like you are writing such sort of, you know, brilliant, sharp sort of, you know, nonfiction, and it's sort of, you know, holding up a mirror and saying, look, this needs to change and the way we think about this and when we talk about this, we, you know, we can do better. But we can do better is a hopeful message, isn't it? It's not just saying, look how dreadful everything is. There's a real motivation to move, not just to escape, to create something positive and new.
Yeah, like I actually feel like that whole thing of we need to get uncomfortable, like I don't really like subscribe to that, because I feel like learning about this stuff is like super liberatory. I don't think it should make people, certainly the stuff that I'm sharing, I don't think should make people uncomfortable. I feel like it should inspire people to know that the way things are organized currently are not just like the way things are, the way things have to be. They're not like these foundational truths. They're one, like, they're the result of one kind of particular vision and set of decisions and choices. There's so many other decisions and choices that exist. And I think like when we find concrete examples of people who organized their societies very, very differently, we see that they're are other ways, there are other ways of being. And I'm really interested in cultures or societies, and this is something I write about like a lot in Disobedient Bodies, that okay, so for instance, like I'm talking about beauty and how beauty is imagined through our current lens, through a political system and a social system that is based on principles of individualism and of competition and of kind of like survival of the fittest. And in what ways do those principles feed into our beauty culture? And obviously things like envy and jealousy are human emotions, irrespective of what political or social system you live under. However, there are political and social systems that, rather than incentivize and encourage our worst tendencies, actually try and mitigate them, you know? So I think thinking about, yeah, these behaviors are human behaviors, they're always going to exist, but how could we live in ways where we try and mitigate rather than encourage our worst impulses?
That's something I feel like I always saw as a reader growing up in your books, was that beauty, especially for women, was a kind of passport. It was almost the only way to travel if you didn't have much of anything else. But also that beauty and who defined that and said what it was and where it could take you.
Something that I write about in Disobedient Bodies is like, you know, that kind of phenomenon whereby like this idea of like beauty is like a passport, and it's like a passport, but like a passport as a second class citizen. And I feel that like beauty is put on this pedestal partially because there's an assumption that people who are perceived as possessing it by extension have love and security and like support and care and protection and all of these things. That's often very far from the case. So why don't we aspire to like create societies where we all have access to those things, rather than where beauty is understood as the necessary thing to possess that will give you access to those things, when we know that like many times it will not. I have examples in the book of, you know, people who are, there's a consensus that they're beautiful, they're seen as being people who possess beauty, and it is something that's actually really put them in the line of fire. And because they're women who are relatively powerless in other ways, their beauty hasn't brought about the positive outcomes that one might imagine. That's like one side of the story, but it's the side that we don't hear about as much. So I try and like approach things from a different angle to the kind of received wisdom. I feel like I'm a bit contrary.
You know, I think that's a great thing to do. And it's always really fascinating. And I think that's why we read, and why I read fiction as much as why I read nonfiction, is to see the other point of view. Is it like, I don't know if you read Yellowface this summer.
I haven't yet.
But I mean, it's a riot, it's a ride, and that protagonist is the worst, but so compellingly awful and so fascinating because she absolutely believes her own nonsense. She's the best kind of unreliable narrator, in that she's sort of, you know, lying to herself and doesn't really want to admit that. Possibly not a great example in terms of, you know, her being sort of contrary and making you sort of think things in a useful way. But I think just, you know, that active, it's like muscular empathy when you're seeing from a sort of a 360 position, and, you know, how people come to think the way they think. And even if you don't agree with them as a reader, it's really, really fascinating to be able to see how they got there and why they did that.
I feel like we live in quite censorious times, kind of whichever side of the spectrum you are on, like political, like whatever the kind of whatever your kind of viewpoint is, there's a script that you are not supposed to deviate from. There's a lot of mantras, there's a lot of buzzwords, there's a lot of like dominant narratives that you're expected to reproduce, whichever kind of side of the debate you're on. And I find that really stifling. My ideas are not always in step with, yeah, what the script is demanding that I say. But I'm also like never telling anybody like what they should think. I also think we live in like really didactic times where there's a real, this is what I think, and you must reproduce this same script as well. And I'm like, this is what I think, and maybe it's like a slightly different way of looking at well-known or much discussed thing. But I'm not saying that you have to think like that either. I'm just saying, here's another way of like considering it.
So I'm reading the most incredible book at the moment, and annoyingly for listeners, it's not out until next year. It is by a writer called Tracy King, Learning to Think. So it's about her growing up in the 70s and 80s in Birmingham. Her mother ends up joining a sort of Christian sect, a strand of Christianity that's kind of imported from America, that's sort of not quite a full cult, but cult adjacent. And her father dies in really tragic and mysterious circumstances, and the family sort of falls apart. And Tracy is left to kind of to find herself, really through books and through also teaching herself how to code with Amstrad computers in the 80s, which is incredible, because she reads lots of kind of like very, very Christian books, and then lots of quite pulpy books and books about mysticism. And I suppose we call it MBS now. I don't know if they use that in the 70s and 80s, but all the books that she was reading, they were very like, well, you know, this is it. This is the truth. This is exactly how things are. Mm-hmm. And she's just encountered the Carl Sagan writing about sort of science and the universe for the first time. You know, she's not really read any science writing. She's read writing that purports to be science writing, but is a bit bossy and a bit mystical. And he's the first writer who said in the text, like, well, but maybe I don't know, or but maybe I'm wrong. And she said the power of that sentence, someone, you know, that she's always believed the authority of books so fully, and to have someone who is obviously very smart and educated, who knows a lot, but is prepared to kind of be ambivalent. I love that in Zadie Smith's essays as well, that, you know, changing my mind, and it feels like a window is being opened in my brain to have someone say, well, I think many things and they don't all marry up, and I couldn't come and confidently tell you anything, but here's my opinion and this might change.
Yeah, I love it. And I think the necessity of that kind of thinking, where we are kind of like politically and socially now, is so important, where you have to have, like, you know, you have to have this certainty on social media. You know, people are just waiting for you to like say something that is like ideologically unsound or wrong. And so people have to take these really immobile, inflexible static positions, which is like so dangerous.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Because nobody ever seems to say, well, I don't know, what do you think? No one has ever sort of seems to be interested in saying, I don't have all the information and I'd love to hear your informed opinion. It's all very, it's like attack is the best form of defence, seems to be the vibe.
And also, you don't want to hear anyone else's opinion because you're trying to like promote yourself, you know? So it's not about dialogue, it's kind of about dominance. Yeah, often.
Have there been any books that politically or philosophically you feel that have changed you?
Yeah, for sure. I read a lot of philosophy from doing my PhD. There is a feminist philosopher called Elizabeth Grosch, who wrote a book called In the Nick of Time, which is about like a kind of a meditation like on time. And on like futures that had the possibility of being realized, but like haven't been or won't be, but like could be. I haven't read it for quite a while. I do reference her a bit in Disobedient Bodies as well. But I find like a lot of philosophy really just very expansive and mind-blowing. Like I really enjoy Nietzsche as well, like Thus Spoke Zarathustra. That book is wicked. It's crazy, actually, because you're like, oh my God, I can kind of, like, there's aspects of it. Like, when he's talking about, like, the last men and stuff, it's crazy when you read something, you know, that's written 100 or, like, over 100 years ago, and it feels, like, also very, like, prescient, and it feels like it could be talking about our times now. I'm just like looking at my book or looking at like one shelf of books. I'm trying to think. I feel a bit overwhelmed. Oh, this book's incredible. But I read a lot of theory because of, I love novels. I love novels, but I read a lot of theory because of my PhD. But this one, Futures of Black Radicalism, that's insanely good.
Who's the author of that one? That's got such a fabulous kind of, I don't know when it was published, but it's got this real sort of like iconic, striking covers. I love the typography of it.
Yes, it's beautiful. It's an edited like collection of essays edited by Guy Theresa Johnson and Alex Lubin. This as well. Oh my God, this is like heavy. I'm like sitting in my office, so I don't really have my novels. This is more like my PhD book, so it's quite like theory heavy, but this is like mind-blowing.
A thousand plateaus,
Capitalism and Schizophrenia. Oh, here's a slim tome. I recommend everyone read this. Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher. This is like so good.
I mean, that looks like a really, really great jumping off point. How do you kind of timetable your reading, for want of a better expression, because I guess you've got to do so much reading and writing. It's your work and it's got to be done, but I imagine that takes lots of kind of, you know, discipline and management in terms of like when you're studying. And
yeah, so my PhD is quite languishing at the moment, to be honest, and if I don't submit it in the next month, that's it. Like, the thing is, it's written, it's just like it exists in like draft form. And I need to like get it into like submission form immediately. And I just don't see how I'm going to have the time to do that in the next month with my book coming out. So yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, I don't want to just, I mean, like, I've learned so much from the process of like doing a PhD for so long. So like in terms of the impact it's had on me outside of getting the doctorate, it's been like profound, but it does also feel like it would be a waste to actually not get the qualification as well. Yeah, I read a lot, and I have to not only read, but then I have to like make sense of what I'm reading to like do my own writing. So my head is pretty full, and I find like that I often, because I have like all of this like theory and like history in my head, and I'm like, I have young children and I'm like extremely busy, I feel that there are really like basic things that I just don't remember. I think like names have really like fallen afoul of the lack of kind of headspace I have. I'm so, so bad with names. And that seems to be like Yeah, I can never remember the names of the books I'm reading as well. Like, I can remember the names, but I won't necessarily remember the author's name, even though I could like quote from the book. So yeah, I don't know. There's a lot going on.
I worry about that all the time because sometimes it's harder than ever for me to like find the word for something, or you know, and I feel like I'm going mad, like something's broken. And I think and I hope it's just because, you know, we are all at capacity
Yeah.
because we now have these wonderful and terrible devices that just allow us to have everything we need to know instantly. We get panicky when our brains don't work the same way and they're not supposed to. And also, we just carry more information, and there are more people and more ideas, and we're exposed to more than we have ever been at any other point in history, surely, I hope.
Like definitely. I feel like under siege, like from just like information and like sensation. You know, it's actually very overwhelming. And I think, yeah, our phones are a huge part of that. Or like just even the amount of people that you're like in communication with is like really like extraordinary. I'm sure there's not been a comparable time in our societies. And you know, like you're out, you're doing something, and then you look at your phone and you read a message, and it's like actually really intense. And like you can't just leave it on read, but you also like can't get into the headspace to like attend to it properly, given like the social situation that you're in. And that's happening like, but also that's happening with work. It's like there's no kind of like boundaries.
Yeah,
Everything is
because
boundless
the
and constant.
intensity of that information means you can no longer be fully present where you are either. A book I really, really loved by a former guest on the podcast, Catherine May. It's her book, The Electricity of Every Living Thing. I don't know if you've read that one, where it's sort of about her plan to kind of do a big coastal walk. I think it's around Devon and Cornwall, maybe, but also that's when she discovers at the very end of her 30s that she is autistic, and about that process of kind of diagnosis and finding that out. And she was saying that maybe 100 or 200 years ago, she probably would have lived in a village or a very small town. She would have known 50 people at the absolute most. She wouldn't have been in situations where there was an overwhelming amount of noise or light. You know, you wouldn't have the sensory hell of going into a shopping centre and not being able to deal. That just wouldn't have come up. And she has a theory, which I fully subscribe to, the way we are kind of all neurodivergent. And I now know lots of people are getting diagnosed as adults. And is it also because these conditions are kind of inhospitable to all, and we just didn't have them, you know, until relatively recently.
I think there's so much to be said for that. That's so interesting. I absolutely love Catherine May's writing. I haven't read that book yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah, I'm pretty like convinced that I'm neurodivergent. I actually got like diagnosed as being like hyperactive when I was a kid. They just didn't do anything about it though. They were just like, yeah, she's got hyperactivity. But yeah, like the kind of like symptoms in terms of like concentration and like sensory things, it seems very relatable to me. But I actually just don't know how to get like the diagnosis. Like it just seems like the amount of obstacle, like it just seems like an impossible thing for me to navigate. So
I'm really, really desperate to read. I think Shepherd Kosandi, the comedian, has just written a book about her ADHD diagnosis. Also, I'm absolutely believe I am neurodivergent, and like you, I don't quite know how or you know where to begin in terms of a diagnosis and what I'd need from that, really. But that having lots of different projects sort of going on and feeling completely overwhelmed by that, but also not really knowing that there could be, you know, another way that it. I don't know about you, but I love knowing that there are many different things I can do and pick up and put down again.
Yeah, like if I'm not doing loads of, I can't just do like one thing. I'd be more likely to kind of be doing nothing. And like, I think I would really struggle to work in like an office or like a corporate environment. So, like being able to dip in and out to a degree of quite different things, I think my mind like responds like quite well to that. I definitely have a tendency to take on like too much, and it can go like way too far. But I think with management, working on different things simultaneously is like the best way for me to work.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
We'll be back with Emma soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Tom Lake by Anne Patchett. It's the story of Lara and her journey from acting to cherry farming, as told to her three daughters over lockdown. This is another book that made me feel as though it has lived in my bones for a long time. There's a spirit-lifting lightness and brightness here, but it is still a very muscular and textured story. It's about hope, expectation, and all kinds of love. Tom Lake is published by Bloomsbury and out now. Now back to Emma. So are there any books you haven't written yet, books that perhaps might surprise us if we think of you and your books?
I started something before I started Disobedient Bodies, and then I was like, got the commission to write Disobedient Bodies. Well, it wasn't Disobedient Bodies, but got the commission to write something about beauty from the Wellcome Trust. So even though I do many things simultaneously, I was also doing like quite a lot of other stuff, so I couldn't maintain the other book. But now that I've finished this one, I'm going to go back to it. I'm writing a novel that is like a satire. I don't know that it will surprise people. I think like the themes that I'm kind of, or the dynamics that I'm looking at, I mean, yeah, I don't know if it will surprise people. Perhaps it will. But yeah, I'm definitely keen to write. I need a break from nonfiction, just because I'm sick of like the pressure of having to like be right, not necessarily right in my opinions, but like, you know, the pressure of the material being like the amount of research that goes into them. Obviously you research a lot for a novel as well, but it is also like a different, it's different to nonfiction, and I'm looking forward to that kind of creative freedom.
When I moved from journalism to fiction, it really did feel like a gear shift, that suddenly, and I couldn't quite believe that I was allowed to do it, that you can just, you know, trust your brain. It's extraordinary, and it's really, really exhilarating. And I think even now I'm still, but is this allowed? I just make it up. Are you sure?
Yeah, that seems so exciting. That's what I want to do.
So which novelists or fiction writers have kind of inspired you in terms of like voice and tone? And are there any novels that have really made you want to do it and want to tell stories?
Yeah, for sure. Like I really, really love Toni Morrison. And I feel like that's like to a large degree because of like the mythic nature of her writing and the way it feels like it is conjuring or channeling in some of her novels more than others, but they feel like quite infused by magic, and they feel like they are channeling like a spiritual world, like a lot of the kind of spiritual world that I like have written about in all of my books, like of Yoruba, which is like my dad's ethnic group, like Yoruba philosophy, Yoruba like kind of metaphysics and like spirituality. I feel like the kind of like echoes of that really like infusing like Toni Morrison's writing. So yeah, I like quite gothic and quite like mythical, like magical realism. Mm. Like I love folklore and mythology. So yeah, Toni Morrison.
Is there a Toni Morrison novel that really especially moved you or that you felt particularly connected with?
Song of Solomon, I think, is probably my favourite. And Paradise. I read Paradise when I was like a teenager, and I remember being like, this is brilliant, but like it's like a woman's book. I was like, when I read this, when I'm like more experienced, when I've lived more, when I'm older, when I've lived more of a life as a woman, I feel like it's going to resonate with me like more deeply. And then I read it again about 4 years ago, and I was just like, oh yeah, like younger me knew. Like it resonated very differently.
It's so interesting that you knew that. Again, it goes back to what you were just talking about with ancient futurism, kind of that being that perception of knowing it meant a lot to you then, and it was going to mean even more to you.
Yeah, I'm really interested in time. Like in Don't Touch My Hair, I have a chapter on time, which I think is probably the chapter that most people have, you know, asked me about or said that it surprised them, but that they enjoyed it. And yeah, I'm interested in, obviously, like in our part of the world, we have like chronological linear understandings of time. But in many cultures, time was perceived as like flowing in like a more cyclical way. Mm. And that idea of the past, present and future being discreetly separate from each other is interrupted, and they're all kind of, you know, coexisting.
Mm.
I believe that like if you read quantum physics, that actually a lot of those notions of time as non-linear actually bear far more relationship to how time does actually operate. Mm. So, you know, people that are dismissed as primitive because of, well, multiple things, but partially because of the, you know, their understandings of time actually are probably more in step with how time behaves.
I've really liked Oliver Burtman's book, 4,000 Weeks, just because it took time as a thing we think we can have some sort of control over and something we can manage and something that we've made dull and administrative and something that we're determined to make it serve us. And him, at the very, 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 very beginning of saying, no, there is some mysticism here. There is something else. There's something bigger, like it controls you. You know, get in line and don't worry about it so much.
And then the relationships, I guess, between like neurodivergency and like time management are interesting as well.
This is such a boring thing, but something that I've thought, oh, that's weird. Like, you know, when someone says that something's being brought forward or pushed back, like, for example, we started speaking half an hour later than was planned. So I guess you could say that was pushed back, but just the way I picture it, I feel like it's being moved forward, because I think of the line and I think that it's being picked up and moved forward. So the idea of something being pushed back, I mean, that it's going to be sooner even, and that's something that whenever someone uses that expression, I really have to stop and think. It's like, oh no, they mean the opposite of what I think.
It feels counterintuitive, right? I never thought of that before.
Ages ago when I worked at Bliss magazine, I remember talking to the receptionist about the hour change. And she was saying, well, no, because, you know, because it's like, it's spring forward, fall back, isn't it? Because it goes forward in spring and back in the autumn. Mm-hmm. And she was like, but if you fall, you fall forward. So the clocks must be going forward in the autumn and spring back, because you'd pull something back before it sprang. I was like, I cannot fault your logic. This is, I can sort of feel, I think I'm having an aneurysm, but yeah, you're right.
That's so funny.
But I think that perhaps comes back to the quantum thing and the cyclical thing, like this idea of trying to make it linear just isn't serving us. It makes no sense. And I suppose a lot like beauty, where, you know, a small group of people have been allowed to set and control a standard, and, you know, something powerful happens when people start questioning that and disrupting that.
Yeah, for sure. But like something that I write about in the book as well is, I don't feel that it's like the solution is just to expand the standard. So one of the kind of main arguments of the book is it's not adequate to just include more types of people in what is like actually quite a destructive system. Rather than inclusion, I would advocate for like transformation. And I make the argument in like quite concrete ways. Like I try and take pains to actually unpack not just the beauty standards that exist, like Western beauty standards that exist, but actually how we assess and measure beauty in this part of the world, in terms of how beauty has been understood as operating in cultures that are very different. So there's like a lot of philosophy in the book. I try and go back. Okay, so I guess my kind of starting premise was, why does everybody I know, women specifically, like have a degree of self-loathing about their appearance, like irrespective of how they actually look, you know? So I'm just like sick of feeling like just that insecurity. I'm like, where does this insecurity like come from? So people say it's like, oh, the advertising industry or unrealistic beauty standards. And yeah, like to a degree, but it's something like far, far more deeply seated than that. So the book goes back to like Plato and ideas about the body that exist in like Greek philosophy, how they are further enshrined through the Cartesian like dualism, the binary view of the world that we inherited from like the philosophy of like René Descartes, and the way in which the body has been imagined as subservient to the mind, as the body and the mind are seen as like kind of inherently separate. The body is like subservient, it's like the slimy desires of the flesh, and then like the mind is the place of rationality and like intellect and like spirituality, like all of these, or spirituality, like spirit over kind of matter. The things that are like unembodied are seen as like the superior things. And then conveniently, men, European men specifically, became associated, like in Western discourse, men became associated with the kind of domain of the mind, and women became kind of imprisoned in the fleshy confines of the body. And we have this like deep-seated actual scorn for the body, and the body is read as feminine, like in Western culture, and I feel like a lot of in Western discourse. And I feel that like a lot of our notions of beauty are like rooted in these things. So I was like, how is beauty understood and assessed? Is it gendered in the same way? Is it understood as something that is physical, that is this singular thing that can be visualized in cultures that have completely different like ontological traditions, and that have different philosophical traditions about the body? And so that's why I was looking at like pre-colonial Yoruba, pre-Christian Ireland, at the Navajo, at Japan. Japanese philosophy and aesthetics is very interesting, and just looking at how different philosophies of the body create different beauty cultures, and what we might learn from ones that are like very different to our own.
I think that is such an interesting point that, and I think, you know, we see it, don't we, now, sort of the conversations we have about making the beauty standard wider and more inclusive. It is a change, but I suppose the fact is that it's not what the standard is, because that has changed and evolved and it's different. It's that it exists. And as you say, that it's always used as a means of division and a means of disempowerment.
And it still proposes that our value is most to be found mostly in our physical appearance.
And I think that's so, because it's also really grinds my gears, for want of a better expression, whenever it's, oh, it's because of fashion magazines, or, oh, it's because of films. Like, no, I think it's a lot like the way we feel about our brains and our butt. And the link is that when we feel that something is wrong, my latest novel, Limelight, is about a young woman who is so desperate to be pretty, and she hates herself for wanting to be pretty. She is furious with herself for failing to fit the standards that she feels obliged to meet. And I think that's why when we put our faith in something as ephemeral and shifting and nebulous as a beauty standard, it's like, well, people can always move the needle, you know, we need something outside that.
Yeah, absolutely. The novel sounds great, by the way. I really want to read that. Yeah, I write about like the fragility. I'd seen that Toni Morrison had quite interesting things to say about beauty. She seems, and I have a quote from her in the book where I think it's from The Bluest Eye, and she talks about going to the protagonist goes to the cinema, and she's just like, this is where she got exposed to two of the most destructive ideas in humanity, romantic love and beauty. And I was like, oh wow, who says that? And then she's like, both of them both breeded like envy, jealousy, and ended in, she's just like, I'm just like, she's critical of like the concepts of these things that are, you know, seen as the kind of held up on a pedestal in our societies, romantic love and physical beauty. And then I dug more to find out more about Toni Morrison's, if she'd kind of expanded on beauty. And I found like a really great interview from the Paris Review that I quote in the book. And she is really skeptical. Oh, also, God, she actually has said quite a lot about beauty, but she spoke about, like, you know, in the 1960s, like the Black is Beautiful movement. And she said, like, she understood it, but she was just like, are we back here again? Like, is that what gives us our humanity, that we're beautiful? Do we have to be perceived as beautiful to be perceived as human? Do we have to like be legible to the white gaze as beautiful? She's just like, no, like I resist, like she's just like, that's too fragile. I've been in like environments where the way I look is like very close is the beauty standard. And I've been in environments where the way I look is far from the beauty standard. And I have like seen the different ways that I'm treated in those different environments. And I'm like, my treatment or like my value as like a human being cannot be like given or withheld according to something like so like arbitrary and so fragile. So the fact that like we're trying to aspire to beauty as the thing that gives us like protection and love and care and support and respect, like to make all of that effort to get to do something that is also so fragile, ephemeral, transient, contingent, can be taken away from you so easily, that just can't be the kind of like, that kind of quicksand cannot be like the foundations that we're trying to, you know, build on. And then I also say this from the perspective of like somebody that like really loves, that you can't necessarily tell this now, but somebody who really loves makeup and who really loves like dressing up, wearing like pretty dresses and stuff. I'm not saying that, I actually talk in the book about the processes of beautification, the processes of like making yourself look like attractive to other people, things like desire. There's nothing like inherently wrong with those things. It's just that we like afford way too much like value on them. They're not the thing. It's not the thing that's like, you know, principally important about us. And we should, you know, really kind of try and shift our priorities. But at the same time, I kind of reject accusations that having an interest in beauty is like frivolous and like irrelevant. But I wish we could enjoy beauty more. I feel like we should be able to enjoy those things. They need to be liberated from the politics of envy, comparison, competition, consumerism. And I try and map out ways in which that could be done, like in the book.
There's a book I adore, and I think it's out of print, but fairly available secondhand. It's the Penguin 20th Century History of Fashion Writing, and it's some journalism and a lot of excerpts from novels, and it's about men and women and how dressing up in particular, beauty rituals too, but so often it's empowering, it's a rite of passage, it's also a little bit about ritual and mysticism.
Ritual is so key, yeah.
People get to kind of own themselves and express themselves through, but I'm sure this is, you explore this a lot in your writing as well. That's why clothes and choice are so important. And even, and you know, the book also has examples of kind of being, I mean, it comes up so much in Cold Comfort Farm, which again is one of those books that feels like it could have been written yesterday. And I think, and I always forget that it is set in a sort of mysterious, it was written to be set in the future. And the, I can't remember her name, but there's a woman who collects bras, this idea that in this future, corsetry for women will sort of be seen, I think, as like barbaric and it'll be obsolete and bras will be like curios. But also Elphine and the sort of the arts and crafts. And she just wants to wear those sort of like floaty dresses and twirl and be free in the hills. And Flora makes her over and wants to kind of make her sleek. And I think Flora, with sort of her clothes and her hair, wants to empower her, but there is that Pygmalion thing of kind of what will she lose in this transformation. But again, the sort, the magic of I can give you a whole new exciting identity, clothes first. And I think there's so much in literature that really celebrates that. And still now when I dress, like me and my friends have a sort of shared obsession with them. Any dress, a black dress with a white collar, anything like that, I can't walk past it in a shop. I've owned at least four over the years, because in ballet shoes, that's Pauline's audition. Have you dread ballet shoes?
No.
Well, for obscure reasons, everyone needs a mordition sort of general outfit to kind of to get your theatre license and impress everyone. And Pauline, the eldest fossil girl, it's black velvet with a white collar. And you know, I'm 38. I'm never going to be cast as Alice in the pantomime. And still buying that mordition dress.
Yeah, I love like how, when did you read it?
Oh my, for the first time, I think I would have been 7 or 8.
Yeah, I love those books that you read when you're so young and they just like still, you know, have this huge influence in your life. I feel like the aesthetics of Anne of Green Gables, like have just never, have been such like a guiding, like a northern star throughout my life.
I love in Anne of Green Gables when she takes Marilla's amethyst, is it a ring or a necklace or a brooch that she loses?
I don't remember the detail. I just remember her dresses, the house and the garden.
So I know that she, Anne, has never seen a diamond and reads about them and thinks that they must be the most fabulous things. And it's just like a sort of, you know, white, boring, sparkling thing. And when she sees an amethyst, she's like, oh, that's exactly what I wanted a diamond to be.
Oh, that's cool. I don't remember that. I should revisit that.
Oh, so do you still hang, is it the, like the puff sleeves?
Yeah, like I'm just looking at one of my rails and there are so many puff sleeves and taffeta. I don't know if there's taffeta in the book. There's like an image I haven't in my mind of.
I feel like there would have been
like
taffeta.
Dresses for like the first time, right? Because she's like an orphan.
Yeah, if ever you want to collaborate on a book about the fashion in Anne of Green Gables, please like get in touch. I would love that.
Perfect.
I would love to know, is there anything that you are really excited about reading once you've handed in the PhD?
I'm excited to like be able to just read, like there's so many books, like I would love to just like spend my days like reading novels. Gosh, off the top of my head, what do I want to read next? I want to read The Fraud, Zadie Smith's new book.
Oh, me too. I think I'm about to take that on holiday with me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Huge thanks to Emma. Disobedient Bodies is published by the Wellcome Collection and out now. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and created by Dale Shaw and me, Daisy Buchanan. To see all the books Emma mentioned, go to acast.com/booked and you can shop the selection on our page at bookshop.org. Find us and follow us on social media at @whybooked, and if you're feeling especially generous, we would hugely appreciate a 5-star review. As well as helping us, you could be helping a new listener find their new favourite book. We'll be back in your ears soon. For now, I leave you with this from Don DeLillo. Writing is a concentrated form of thinking.
I don't know what I think about certain subjects, even today, until I sit down and try to write about them. See you next time.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.